The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we continue with listeners' questions.
Kevin, this is our last and final week for this year's Q&A, and I think this is my favorite part of the year.
Yeah.
So we'll dive right in. We've got a full battery of questions to answer.
All right. Now, David, the next question is from Edna. She's a medical doctor. She said, "My husband and I are customers of McIlvaney and followers of your financial programs. What do you think the collapse of the U.S. financial system will look like? The hyperinflation of Zimbabwe and the Weimar Republic involved lots of paper currency. But in the U.S., we use credit cards, checking, and digital banking. Do you think a bank holiday will result in cash-only transactions or a barter system? Or will our high-tech lifestyle keep pace with the changes of prices? Perhaps someone will make a hyperinflation app for an iPhone by then. My question is this. Do you think the present U.S. dollar will be reset and a gold standard will be reinstated? Will the present U.S. dollar go the way of the continental?" You know, those are a lot of questions. It sounds fractured, but in a way, David, it really is leading to one thing. What about the dollar?
Well, there are a number of interesting things to consider there. What does hyperinflation look like in a cashless society? That in itself is very fascinating, and it makes me recall a recent trip to Central America where, you know, if the fishermen are not in a peak season where there's any tourists coming in and they have ready cash coming in, then
right.
Guess what they immediately revert to when the tourists go away and the cash flow dries up? They are exchanging services and goods without any cash or any currency or anything of the sort changing hands. I'll come over and work on your fence if tomorrow you can help me move X, Y, and Z.
Sure.
And you work out what you need on a societal basis, on the basis of a negotiated, you know, service slash barter, anything that Edna was addressing that in part. Kevin, the bottom line question, what does the present U.S. dollar look like? Could we go back to a gold standard? We addressed that in our interview with Giulia Garrodi, and the issue is not under the current monetary regime, not under the current political regime. Anything's possible if those two things change, but you're talking about the power structures of the Fed saying, okay, guess what, guys? We were wrong. We're sorry. Since 1913, we've been approaching this completely backwards. What we really need is discipline in the monetary system, something like the gold standard. What are the odds of one of the most powerful organizations in the world, our central bank, or frankly, any other central bank, admitting that?
So you're saying maybe Ben Bernanke go back to Princeton, or, you know, Alan Greenspan go back to Walmart? It was what you're basically saying.
If you appreciate human nature, you can see the conundrum. You've got power politics and people with influence having to admit that they were wrong. The last time I saw that happen was probably 20, 25 years ago in Tanzania, where a communist stepped forward and said, in his sort of State of the Nation address, guys, I was wrong. Communism and socialism doesn't work. We're retooling the entire country more towards capitalism. And there's been a renaissance in Tanzania since. But how often does that happen? I can think of once
yeah.
in the last century.
Right.
And this guy was not a central banker. So, and he didn't write a PhD on how it's better to inflate than deflate. I think gold being a part of our monetary system is a low probability event. What could happen, Kevin, is that the U.S. dollar plays less of a role in the future, and a basket of currencies, including gold, play more of a role in terms of international trade and in terms of central bank reserves.
So you'd have an implied discipline to a degree if gold was in that basket.
Exactly. Yeah. And central bankers would not have to admit they're wrong. They can continue to inflate, but to a lesser degree. To a lesser degree, because one of the component parts in this basket of currencies could be gold.
That takes us to the next question from Mark then, and I think you've started to answer this in this one. He asks, is a little bit of inflation needed for growth to happen? I mean, that's what we're taught. Even if you take economics in school, a little bit inflation is needed for growth.
It can promote a certain type of growth, Kevin, but I would suggest that it's temporary in nature. You know, when you think about the growth of an economy and the development of Kevin, I think of the book, The Mainspring of Human Progress. You know, there you're looking at growth being tied to innovation and efficiency, ideas. You know, the classic example of creating a pencil by specializing in the component parts, where one person somewhere in the world is focusing on growing the trees that end up being the wood as a part of that pencil. One person is extracting the rubber from the rubber trees to become the eraser. And what that specialization allows for is a tremendous amount of free time and added resources to go do other things. And there's nothing really inflationary as a part of that process. When you think about innovation and driving efficiency, it has nothing to do with inflation. Inflation can smooth the economic cycle, as we talked about in a previous question, and inflation can benefit asset owners, and inflation is generally bad for creditors, but that's where I think the merits of inflation end. So with a qualified fire, there's some people who benefit from inflation and others who don't. Classic example is insurance companies. You give an insurance company money today, and they benefit from the present value of that asset, and they invest it and try to stay ahead of the rate of inflation.
Sure.
And what they've done is guarantee you a fixed benefit, a future value, which is a fixed benefit, which will be dramatically impacted by inflation. But they have the advantage of inflation. You have the disadvantage. So all that to say, Kevin, inflation does benefit certain segments in society, but I would not predicate growth of the economy on inflation.
So the person who loses in inflation is the guy who actually just keeps his money in cash or gets very little return because he's going negative to the inflation. Okay, Dave, this question is from Bruce. Given the opinion that we're in uncharted waters and that we really don't know what to expect, we're witnessing the debasement of all currencies, and that there appears no recovery on any horizon, does the 3-to-1, 2-to-1, 1-to-1 Dow gold timing signal hold the same weight and value as it once did? Do you think there may exist alternative asset classes that would vary from the traditional stocks and bonds and real estate when that time comes?
Kevin, I'm going to start with a small point that Dale made in a previous question, which was he said, I appreciate the decision rules you put around this particular exit or reduction strategy.
Mm-hmm.
The decision rules, that's something that needs to be seared into your brain. As an investor, you have to have parameters for your investments. When you're buying, when you're selling, on what basis are you buying, on what basis are you selling? And as much of that as you can do ahead of time, outside of the context of stress, the better the decision will ultimately be.
You know what it reminds me of? It's the checklist when the engine stops and you're flying the plane. I mean, that's when the stress is hitting. You don't want to be thinking about the sequence of events from that point forward to get the engine restarted.
Now, we are in an unprecedented territory. We don't know what to expect. You know, the 3-to-1, 2-to-1, 1-to-1 ratio, we may see that number go negative. That's possible.
Right.
Theoretically, that's possible, where the price of gold exceeds the current value of the Dow and the 30 stocks that make up that component. The suggestion I would have is that by reducing your total holdings one-third initially, and reducing the remaining part of your portfolio by one-third, and reducing the remaining part of your portfolio an additional one-third at those increments, 3-to-1, 2-to-1, 1-to-1.
But you're just taking a third of a third, or you're taking a third of what was there.
A third of what remains.
Yeah, right.
Then what you've done is you have substantially reduced, according to those, again, what we would call, or what Dale has called, the decision rules. You've done what you needed to do on a disciplined basis. And if things are in fact unprecedented and go beyond what we think is reasonable in terms of the price of gold or the devaluation of the Dow, guess what? You're still very well protected, having a significant portfolio that remains in the metals.
You still have that core position. Okay, Dave, this leads us to the question from Steve Abram. I hear David, as well as other sources, talk about debt to GDP ratio of various countries, yet it seems to be relatively difficult information to obtain. Where can I get good data?
Let me jump to that, Kevin. There's two places that I would suggest. One, if you haven't subscribed to The Economist, it's important to. In the back of The Economist, there is a number of things that you'll find: trade balances, current account balances as a percentage of GDP, interest rates on 3-month and 10-year government bonds, you know, market returns globally in the various stock markets around the world, current and projected GDP, industrial production numbers, consumer prices, unemployment. That in itself is worth the price of admission, because you're getting that on a weekly basis. That may be more than you want, so at least stop by the news stand once a month and get it if you can't handle those numbers every week. The second thing I would point to is John Williams, who at shadowstatistics.com produces great work on a regular basis, drawing from Fed numbers, drawing from Treasury numbers.
But he independently compiles those numbers and takes the politics out of the adjustment.
Exactly. Yeah. So as a source for statistics and a very reliable source, I would look both at The Economist, and you're talking about the last two or three pages. Of course, the commentary that they have throughout is invaluable. But if you're just looking for the stats, there it is. And then shadowstatistics.com, John Williams.
Okay, David, this question is from Ed in Georgia. He says, as a McIlvaney client, I'm consistently edified by the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. So here's my question. Do you see any type of event occurring that will awaken the policymakers to face reality? Perhaps a better question is, what type of event will it take? I've often thought it might take a Boris Yeltsin-type moment to defy the entrenched establishment. What do you think, Dave?
Kevin, I think if you look at Europe, you have a work in process, exactly what we're talking about, an awakening amongst policymakers. And it's happening because there's an awakening amongst the general public. What's happening is really a polarization of political extremes. You've got the far right and the far left, and everyone is scattering one direction or the other. And what you'll see is, in a democracy, you're going to see the extremes play out more dramatically. If that's in the States, maybe you're talking about the extreme right and the extreme left as well. No different than Europe, wherein everyone is pushed out of the middle. I'm not sure I'm particularly enthused about that, but that's what we have in front of us. Personally, outside of a democracy, I don't see extreme change happening. As we mentioned in an earlier question relating and tying in Tanzania into the mix, that was in a very autocratic and authoritarian manner, where one man said, we will change, and we will change now.
Right.
We don't have that in democracy.
Well,
and I don't think we would necessarily want one person with that much power making the decree. That assumes that he's making the right decisions to begin with. So in a democracy, what you're looking at is the consequence of polarization.
David, the next question actually asks two different forms of the question. David, the next question actually is in relation to Chinese currency manipulation. And then he adds, do you feel that there at some point will be a U.S. debt default? Let's start with China.
The Chinese currency manipulation, I think it's important to note that they're not alone. I mean, we've had currency intervention, which is the short-term version of manipulation, by South Korea, Brazil, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, the U.S., Canada, Australia, all have or are manipulating their currencies. So this is what we've talked about in past weeks, Kevin. A currency war is not singular in nature. It's not you standing out there like an Irish boxer with no one in front of you. You've got multiple parties, and everybody wants the same thing, and it's a war because everyone's after the same thing.
It's like a mass street fight. Everybody's just slugging each other.
So currency manipulation, it's because we're all doing it at the same time that it is a problem. The second part of the question, Kevin, U.S. debt default, it's happening. It's happening. Default, as we understand it, needs to be redefined, because we're not talking about, you know, not making a payment on U.S. treasuries. We'll continue to make payments. There is no need for them to default along those classic lines on our foreign debt.
So what would a default look like if it's not the old-fashioned kind of, goodbye, guys, we can't pay our debt?
Unlike past periods, Kevin, where you had a creditor and debtor relationship, we have denominated all of our debt in dollars, which means we don't have to default, as in not make a payment. We'll just continue to make payments with dollars that have been devalued. We can always make the payment because we have a printing press. And so the point is, we are in default now, by paying off our debts with cheaper and cheaper dollars. And this is, I think, what's so telling, Kevin, about this last G20 meeting in Seoul. We had the resounding voice of the G20 saying to the U.S. and our monetary policymakers, stop it. Stop it. This is insane. Stop it. $600 billion. What you're doing is destroying the dollar. You owe us money in dollar terms, and you are informally defaulting on your payments. Stop it. So the question is, can we continue into another round of quantitative easing when we already have our foreign creditors saying, the game is up, we know what you were doing?
Well, and look what China and Russia agreed to right after they said stop it. They agreed to stop trading dollars amongst themselves. When they're trading with each other, it's their own currency. Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
Kevin, the next question is from Joseph, and it explains that he has a pretty significant position in physical metals, and then has quite a bit in cash as well, both in his 401k and outside of his 401k. And he asks, given the economic climate as well as continued policy by the Federal Reserve, I wonder if it would be wise to take a distribution on my 401k, pay the tax, the 10% penalty, and move it into equities or gold ETFs denominated in foreign currencies. Could I just increase my cash reserves? Really, what do I need to do to preserve value in this period in time? I'd like to know if investing abroad still can be achieved, and is that a part of the solution? So, Kevin, in answer to the first part of that question, I would be very hesitant to withdraw things from a 401k because of the tax ramifications. What I would suggest is, look at your age, and if you're 59 and a half or older, consider the 59 and a half rule, which allows you to roll out of a 401k into an IRA and gives you greater discretion about with the assets that you can invest
sure.
in. So the 59 and a half rule, that's one thing to do some research on. And the second is most 401k programs have loan provisions in which you can take a loan and you're paying interest back to yourself. So it's a win-win situation. If you want greater control of the asset and you want to pare out $100,000, $300,000, whatever it may be, out of your 401k and have discretion of that.
So it's quite different from debt to a bank. It's basically debt to yourself over the period of time that you're going to be adding to that 401k for the next couple of years.
Yeah. Correct. In answer to sort of what should be in cash reserves, what is appropriate, certainly a minimum of 5 to 6 months, 4 to 5 months perhaps, but 5 to 6 months up to a year, we're talking about cash. And if there's concern that that may be too much in U.S. dollars, then here's an easy solution. Keep half of it in U.S. dollars and half of it in Krugerrand. It's a cash equivalent item in the sense that it's incredibly liquid. You can turn it in 2 seconds and have it turned into dollars if you need it to pay bills or whatever else. So you balance out your quote-unquote liquidity position with some of it being gold bullion and some of it being the actual cash and currency.
David, Joseph goes on to say in the second part of his question, beyond that, I would like to know if investing abroad can still be achieved. I seem to recall that earlier this year, your program reported that there was legislation that recently passed that blocked the flight of privately held U.S. dollars.
Kevin, certainly there is a lot of legislation and pressure mounting for those who would want assets overseas, because we're talking about a brewing currency crisis here in the United States. And the last thing that you can afford to have is outright flight capital.
Right.
That's when it's basically the rats jumping ship. You know, when you begin to see them move down the rope and off the boat, you have to wonder, well, do they know about the hole under the deck? That certainly is in play. And to the extent that you can eliminate the access to land, if you will, or not allow the rats to escape, that really is what we're talking about. That will continue. There are a number of programs. We've set up a number of programs to allow for physical metal storage in Switzerland. That, to us, is one alternative. A subsequent question, Kevin, not necessarily in this, but one that's often asked by our clients is, what about a second place to live?
Mm-hmm.
What about a second passport? What about having a footprint internationally? I would probably go back to Barton Biggs' comment in his book, Wars, Wealth, and Wisdom, which is, under extreme duress, you can't get there.
Right.
So you've got the perfect ideal scenario of a small farm in New Zealand, and the problem is no one can even supply jet fuel to the planes that are on the taxiway. How are you going to get there? That's a long swim, my friend. So Barton's suggestion, and I mean this is a mainstream Wall Street guy, is own a farm or a family retreat, which is at least one or two gas tanks away from a major city. End of story. You know, of course, I think my dad has a slightly different opinion, having more international exposure. He lives overseas 6 months out of the year anyway. So he's accomplished that through a change in lifestyle.
Sure.
If that's what you want to do, I would suggest that as opposed to planting a flag somewhere, adopt what Harry Schultz has long called the permanent tourist approach to international living, in which you don't have to choose a country. You live everywhere,
well,
or anywhere you want.
And I do know, I've talked to people who chose the country without ever going. I would imagine you're going to tell them, make sure you go, spend a little bit of time there, find out what the culture's like if you are planning on moving.
Certainly.
David, this question is from Australia. This is from Matthew. He says, I'm an avid listener to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary from Australia. I stumbled on your podcast earlier this year after reading the book Fooled by Randomness. one of the best books on investing in financial markets that I've ever read.
Which I would wholeheartedly agree with.
One of the thoughtful journalists recommended was Alan Abelson in the aforementioned book, who you did an interview with a year ago. That was how I found your podcast. I was wondering if David could perhaps give a list of his favorite books or financial newsletters that have shaped his development and his view in recent times. Perhaps this could become a regular blog on this website.
Kevin, what I was thinking is, you know, starting January 1st, we do have in our resource section on the website a number of books which we've read as a company or do recommend. And I could make that more thorough. Some of them are going to be more academic and not necessarily of interest to a general reader. What I would encourage any listener to do is to read that which they are interested in. Don't look at a book list and say, okay, this is the mandatory list to understand what's happening in this or that subject. The best way to be a student is to be very, very practical about your interests. What are you curious about? If that's what you're curious about, then read on it until you've exhausted all of your questions. And in the context of pursuing answers to the questions that you had, you're going to be developing other questions in other areas, and allow that curiosity, the energy that's internally generated, to fuel the next read.
And not just for books, David. I mean, that's really what you've encouraged on this show. What are we looking for? The question is, what are we interested in? What is it that we don't know the answer to right now, and who can we talk to get the answer?
Right. So we will put up a more exhaustive list starting in January in the resource section on our website. That's a great point. For us, education, if this is ridiculous to call it this, but the democratization of information.
Right.
This is the beauty of the web page. This is the beauty of the internet age. You have access to the equivalent of master's and PhD material at your fingertips. You don't have to sign up for courses at Yale or Princeton or Harvard to be able to learn if you are curious and if you want to know.
Well, you know, speaking of personal experience and people bringing in their own interests each time, he continues the question. It's actually less of a question than a statement. He says, on a quick side note, as a point of interest, I actually grew up in Zimbabwe, the oft-talked-about country that David uses to demonstrate the horrors of hyperinflation. I was young when it happened, but I remember the price of a Coke soaring from 20 cents to $6, almost overnight. I visit the country every year or so and have a multicolored collection of billion and trillion dollar notes, actually referred to as bearer checks. So this was called money, and the actual expiry date stated on it, usually a couple of months, was printed on normal paper with no security features. In fact, Germany ceased flying. This is great, David. Germany ceased flying the correct paper over after Zimbabwe could ironically no longer afford to pay for its money with the printed money. Perhaps it was growing up in this environment, but I all too well understand the dangers of a fiat money in corrupt hands. I can only hope this same fate is not lying wait for America, and commend your efforts to educate and inform. Isn't that interesting? Germany stopped flying the paper over, David, because what they would print on it couldn't buy the paper.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Kevin, the next question comes from Dave in California, and he's an engineer, most certainly. I can't read the page upon page of preamble leading to the question, but the point is this. We're moving into an age where we expect linear things to occur. If this, then this. We have an understanding of relationships, economic, financial, political, and the problem is things don't always hold together the way they're supposed to.
So it's not always linear. It sometimes becomes nonlinear, or the pattern gets broken?
Yeah, for instance, and he uses this as an illustration, a linear system example is the simple motion equation that relates force, time, and momentum. If we apply force to a car, it moves. If we double the time over which we apply the force, the speed of the car doubles. If we keep applying force, the car goes faster and faster, but eventually a wheel will come off.
Right.
Now the system has gone nonlinear, and the equation, which assumes linearity, no longer applies. The rules don't work anymore. And that's the question that he's asking is, in this environment, what do we see politically, financially, economically, that we assume linearity, but we're now pressing the envelope? Kevin, just last night, I'm reading a CNN communique, which CNN Money says, okay, we've just learned from the Fed that to bail out the banks in 2008, overnight lending reached $9 trillion. $9 trillion to make sure that the banking system in America, not globally, but in America, did not come unhinged, did not go nonlinear.
That's the equivalent of our entire government debt.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's absolutely unbelievable. Keep that in mind, Kevin. $9 trillion was not just sitting on the shelves to be handed out. It was instantly created and distributed. And then, of course, as the overnight lending requirements were lessened, it came back to the Fed and they could eliminate it. But think of that. $9 trillion in liquidity was created instantaneously.
Well, think about what would have happened to the system without the $9
trillion. I know. So this gets to Dave's point. We are now in an era where I think you can expect non-linearity, where you can expect the wheels to come off very unexpectedly because things occur outside of the normal process. No one in their right mind would have assumed, no economist, no financial advisor, no one related to the banking community would have dreamed that $9 trillion would have been required for the banking system to stay together. And in fact, Kevin, when you look at how frail the banking system remains today, after a $9 trillion lifeline, you realize just what trouble we're in.
Well, and you know, Dave, when he finishes his question, he actually ends up with the interest rate question. He wants to know, where do you think interest rates are headed now that we've either gone nonlinear or if we're still linear when we do go nonlinear? Where are the interest rates headed, Dave?
Kevin, this is where you think you could see a disconnect where the official rate, the Fed funds rate, is kept artificially low. The Fed is committed to that liquidity mandate. They want to keep things together. They want to maintain asset prices. They want to improve employment. This is the new dual mandates that they've added to the original 1913 mandates. And I think this is where you begin to see a disconnect because the market begins to discount the reality of bad monetary policy, and at the mid or end of the yield curve, interest rates begin to creep, even while the Fed funds rate is zero, or less than zero, as we've talked about before. Less than zero.
But the longer-term loans are going to tell the truth.
Exactly. So I think, Kevin, where you begin to see non-linearity in the interest rate market, particularly the U.S. bond market, is when we have an auction failure, and the U.S. government, Fed, Treasury, separate entities, are expecting our foreign creditors to return and purchase their regular bout of treasuries, when in fact, they just don't show up.
Well, and that's a real fear right now, as you've mentioned before, since in the next 5 years, 70% of our debt has to roll over. It comes due and has to roll over.
Yeah, because, Kevin, the problem is we're now talking about a compounded problem. If you don't have someone show up and you're short an extra $5, $10 billion, guess what? The Fed can sop it up. That's what that monetization has been. Quantitative easing has allowed the Fed to increase their balance sheet and just pick up all the treasuries that are left or mortgage-backed securities that people don't want and bring stability to those markets. But what if it's not $5, $10, $20 billion, but you've got the rollover stuff that has to be renewed, re-upped, in addition to your current funding needs, and it's in the $400, $500, $600, $700 billion in one fell swoop? And it's not quantitative easing 3, which will be spent between now and June, say a 6-month period, but it's instant, the cash is needed now, and what you're looking at is a liquidity crisis. The liquidity crisis ultimately gives everyone a peek behind the kimono and reminds them, oh, you guys are actually insolvent. I guess we knew that. But we were always planning on the liquidity sequence being in line, being linear, and there never being an issue. We never had to worry about your solvency because we knew you had your liquidity lined up.
So when that happens, in layman's terms, interest rates spike. Just like what we saw in Europe with some of these pig countries, all of a sudden, these to sell a bond, they're having to double or triple the amount of interest that they're paying.
That's exactly right. Kevin, as we wrap up, I'm reminded of the quality of the questions. In fact, every time I get on the phone with a client, the high level of their intelligence, the things that they're concerned about, the care and concern that they have for their families, their communities, and the fact that these are not just trivial curiosities. These are not just intellectual curiosities, but they want to know, have to know, are trying to be perspicacious in this particular time period. They want to make the wisest decisions to afford their families safety and preservation and well-being. And so there is a deep commitment. As I read through these questions, there's a deep commitment to understanding the truth and to doing the right thing with the information. And all I can say, Kevin, is that we certainly are only beginning point in that understanding process. We encourage our clients to continue educating themselves, to continue reading. This is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of understanding political issues, geopolitical issues, financial issues, economic issues. You can plumb the depths. We are thankful for the fellowship as we ask similar questions and you join us in the dialogue.
Well, David, you've mentioned so many times to me before how humbling it is to be talking to the quality of these people and the depth of their care. And I know your father felt the same way for decades here at this firm as well. I mean, this is a four-decade-old firm. The people that we've talked to and who listen to this show, many of them, they're like family members. And we just want to thank the listeners for sending the questions in this year. They were fascinating, and frankly, I learned a lot.
So as a preview of coming attractions between now and the end of the year and coming into next year, we're going to do our best of 2010, the interviews and the commentaries, which we've gotten strong feedback on as the best programs for this year. So just to give you a thumbnail sketch of five, six, seven different programs, the topics discussed, the insights hopefully brought out, and then we'll begin to move into January with some prognostication as to where we think things may go from an economic, financial, and political standpoint here and internationally for 2011.
David, that's just another reason to keep listening. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. You can give us a call also at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.